Call your attention to the book of Acts. I almost said the Gospel of Acts, but it's not the Gospel of Acts. It's just the Acts of the Apostles. The sermon today is simply this: God winked, but now. Now, there are books that are out called basically God Winked. I know about that because Brother Bill has shared those with me. And a couple of weeks ago when we went fishing, we were talking a little bit about that again. And he was telling me some of the stories that he has been blessed by. The God Wink series basically has to do with God working in a person's life, giving them maybe some type of special visitation, maybe a circumstance, totally unexpected. And then all of a sudden, the Lord shows up in a special way. And God winked because nobody was expecting it, and then God just happened. Let me tell you a story. On Days Run Together, I think it was Thursday, I was visiting. I went to see a gentleman that's not a member of this church. But he wanted to tell me this story. He and I have been friends a long time. So I went to his home. I had made a visit, left there, and I thought, I'm close by. I'll go see him. He's been battling cancer. Stage 4 originally. He says that they're saying it's stage 3 now. He had a tumor in his lower colon about the size of a tennis ball. That began to shrink. It got down to about the size of a golf ball. He said they were doing the surgery after it had shrunk, and they took about 3 inches or so of his colon out. And he said, I'm there, and he said, Brother Tommy, he said, I'm telling you, it is beyond my ability to describe how awful this pain has been. He said, my wife had already gone home, and he said, I'm there. He said, the nurses have given me everything that they can give me, and it's not helping. And he said, I am in horrific pain. And he said, it was not an audible voice, but he said, I could hear it in my mind. And he said, I heard God say to me in my mind, I know your pain. And he said, the first thing that I did was I lashed out. No, you don't. You don't know this pain. And he said, the moment I said that, he said, I was smitten in my conscience. He said, I'm sorry, Lord. I did not mean to be disrespectful. I did not mean to not show you honor. But he said, Lord, I'm hurting. I need help. And he said, I cannot explain it. He said, this is a Sunday night. He said, but all of a sudden, it began at the top of my head and began to go down my body, and there was a warmth. And he said, this warmth, he said, it did not take the pain away, but it lessened it greatly, and I was able to bear it. And he said, I began to have a sweet, sweet fellowship with the Lord. And he said, that went on for a couple of hours. And then finally, I was able to drift off to sleep. The next day, the pain started coming back again. And that night, everybody had gone home, and I'm there, and that same warmth began to come over me again. And he said, for 2 nights in a row, he said, I have never experienced the fellowship with God that I had until that time. He said, even as wonderful as it was when I got saved, it was not to that degree. And I called his name and I said, you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of the story of Moses. And he's up on the mountain. And he needed the Lord to just kind of solidify in his mind, this is what you need to do. And God said, put your face in the cleft of the rock. And God passed behind him. And the glory of God basically ricocheted off of that crevice that he was in back to him. And it so brightened his own countenance that when Moses came off the mountain, he had to veil himself. That is one type of God winking. That's not the kind that we're going to look at today. And so I want you to just think about the passage of Scripture that we are in this morning. The first thing that we're going to look at is we're going to look at what I call the prelude. The prelude. Verse 16, it says, "Now while Paul waited for them in Athens." What does that mean? Well, if you were to back up to chapter 16, you'll know that that is the story when Paul saw the Macedonian vision, took a boat, went to what we know as Europe, went to Europe, and basically began to preach. He went to Philippi, went to Thessalonica, went to Berea, and ultimately he went to Athens. But he had left his co-workers. There were two people that he had left in Thessalonica, and then they probably came through Berea on their way to Athens. He had left Silas, who was his partner for the second missionary journey. Then he picked up young Timothy and even Luke. And so you've got Acts 16. He's leaving his team, and he's going to Athens, and he's going to be there by himself. He's going to be there until those men come, and they're going to try to begin to share the gospel in Athens the same way that they had done in Thessalonica and the same way that they had done in Philippi. And so you look with me at verse number 16. It says, "His spirit was stirred in him." In other words, there was something that was beginning to swell up on the inside of him. And what was causing that? He saw that the whole city was given over to idolatry. Now, he had seen idols before. I mean, he was a Jewish kid. He was taught the Ten Commandments from the time that he was a little kid. And he knew, number two, no graven images. But here he is, he's walking through the ancient city of Athens. Athens that has been around for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And this place is nothing but one big idol plantation. It's been estimated that there are over 30,000 statues of pagan gods that were in ancient Athens. And so he is agitated in his spirit. Now he is trying to wait till his buddies get there. He's trying to wait till Silas and Timothy arrive. But as he's walking the streets, he sees this idol. He sees that idol. And it just begins to rise up. And when he does, he just says that he began to dispute in the synagogue. Now, this is what he normally would do when he would go to a town. He would usually find the synagogue. And that was because there was somebody that had been basically raised the same way that he had been. And he could take the scriptures and he could dispute and basically argue with them. And so he is there in this synagogue that's in Athens. And so he's looking for some devout people. People that are serious about their Judaism. Serious about trying to obey the Torah. He is serious about that, and he expects other people to be serious about that as well. And so, as you see that he is there, he is looking for these devout people, but he is also going in the marketplace. Now, you got to remember, when we think of going to the market, we think of going and buying food. I know that there are times that when I go to a marketplace, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for something that's good to eat. One of the favorite places that I like to go to the DeKalb Farmers Market. I don't go very often, maybe once a year at the most, But I like going in that place. They got 47 different kind of breads. They got all kind of desserts. They got 1,000 spices. They've got all types of vegetables. I'm talking about vegetables that you have never heard of, and I haven't either, till you read it on the sign. It is one neat place to go. You can go to a seafood section, and you can go, I didn't even know that fish was in the ocean. It's just that kind of place. It is a market where that you can get all of that kind of stuff. Well, this would have food. It would be very similar to what you would see if you went to a market in Jerusalem. But it was so much more. This would be where there would be little groups of people that would be together, and they would be discussing things. We'll see a little bit more of that here in our next verse. And it says, so he is in the marketplace daily with them that met with him. So not only is he talking to the Jewish people at the synagogue, he's talking to the Gentile people that are there in the roadways and in the byways in the market area, talking to them about the Lord. And so he is witnessing to them. But then there is a group of people that we're introduced to. Then, after his time in the synagogue and after how he has been disputing with them and how that then he is witnessing, all of a sudden there's a rumor that's going around, and two well-known groups go, this man is kind of stirring things up. We want to hear some more. They always wanted to hear more. And so it says in verse 18 that there were a group of people that were philosophers. They were the Epicureans, and there were the Stoics. When you see those people, you've probably heard those names. If you've ever done any type of world history, there was a man named Epicurus. That's the guy that was the founder of this group. The founder of the Stoics was a man named Zeno. And these were the two prominent, really, philosophies, even though there were hundreds and hundreds of them that would be scattered because they loved talking. How many of you have ever heard of a guy named Socrates? If you haven't, you've slept through class in school. Know thyself. What about Plato? Anybody ever heard of Plato? Whenever your kids go to school, have you ever sent your kid to something called an academy? Plato was the first guy to have an academy. Not for children, but for like young people. It was like one of the first universities. You've got Aristotle. And what he did was, you know, old Socrates, he was talking about know thyself. In other words, look internal. And Plato, he talked a lot about metaphysics. And now Aristotle's trying to merge the two. And so you've got all of these guys that are well known. And they're not just well known to us, they were well known then. And so you've got all of these people that were living 200 years before Christ. And now you've got these people, which is probably somewhere around 45, maybe B or AD. And so they're talking and they're thinking about their past and their glorious past and how bright their philosophers are. And every time I think about whenever they're so prideful, all I'm thinking is, didn't you make Socrates commit suicide? You made him drink poison. But they forget about that. And so they have these Epicureans, and what did they do? They basically believed indulging. Everything was about the now. Eat, drink, and be happy, for tomorrow you die, and when you die, you're like a dog, it's over. And so therefore, I guess you could probably use the word hedonism with these people. Well, what about the Stoics? They were the opposite. They thought that there ought to be just an indifference. When we tell somebody, well, you're pretty stoical about that, that means that we just kind of think that they're just not bothered by it, they're indifferent to it. And so that was the way that Zeno, their founder, had taught them. He basically said, you know, God's everywhere. What's going to be will be. When you die, you die. None of them believed in the hereafter. And so you see that he has encountered them. And something that I thought was pretty neat, the middle of verse 18, it says, they encountered him, and some said, what will this babbler say? You know what a babbler is? It's a seed picker. You say, what in the world is that? Well, what do you have when you have a bunch of little sparrows around? They're bouncing along the ground, and they're picking up a seed here, picking up a seed there. They're bouncing all over the place. And this became known as a slight, a way to make fun. And so they're going, well, he's talked to the Jews, and he's talked to some of our people, and the Epicureans have been talking to him. And these, you know, the Stoics are like, yeah, we're talking to him as well. And then others say, well, he's been telling them all of these things that he believes. So let's hear what the seed picker's got to say. And so what they didn't understand is that they were guilty of what they were accusing him of being. Because every time somebody would come to town, they would say, well, let's see what this new doctrine is. So they were always picking up this and there, and so they're being critical of him. What will this babbler say? He seems to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. Now, when you see that and you hear that, can I tell you that the way he's about to go through this witnessing is different than he has done before? This man is wise. Now, I don't know if you know what 1 Corinthians 9:22 says, but this is a verse that I learned early on, and it says this: to the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. So in other words, Paul was telling the people at Corinth, he said, if I knew that there were brothers and sisters that were weak in the faith, I would try to identify with them to try to bring them to a more mature position. Whether he was talking to Jewish people or Gentile people, one thing this man knew, he knew his audience. He absolutely knew his audience. And so the second thing that we're going to see today is we're going to see the proclamation. The proclamation. What is he saying? Well, if you look with me beginning in verse 22, it says that he stood up in the midst of Mars Hill. Mars Hill is the place where the god Mars, which was a god of war, where he was to be honored. Maybe a name that some people would know is the Areopolis. So you've got him standing up, and he begins to try to preach, but he does it in a very special way. His witness is wise. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I have made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. So what's he doing? He is finding common ground with them, and so he takes a hook to hook them in. Now, I'll read that hook to you in just a moment, but let me ask you something. Have you ever heard about public speakers and how that they try to get a hook to draw you in? You have books that do the same thing. I like reading. Like, excuse me. Those those allergies are just about gone. I like reading. And you may remember this. Let me ask you if you can remember. How many of you remember the beginning of a book and this line is in it? Call me Ishmael. It's not the Bible. Okay. It's not the Bible. A secular book, and that is one of the first things that's in it. Call me Ishmael. All right. How many of you, when you were in high school, read Moby Dick? All right, five of you. The rest of you skip class. All right. All right. Let me ask you another one. It was the best of times, and it was the worst of times. What are you saying, Bill? Tale of Two Cities. That's exactly right. The Tale of Two Cities. Let me give you my favorite. And I don't know why I like this. This ranks right up there with Paul was an ugly baby. I mean, it just ranks right up there with this. All right? It says this. It says, it was a bright day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Now, you don't have any clocks that I know of that strike 13. And so this guy is grabbing us. You know where that comes from? How many of you think the times in which we live and some of the beliefs that are out there today are wackadoodle? You know, how many of you just go, I can't believe somebody actually endorses that. It's crazy. Anybody ever heard of a guy named George Orwell, 1984? That's the way that this book starts. It was a bright day in April and the clocks were striking 13. So things were nuts in his book and things are nuts today. Well, Paul is using a hook. One of the things that you don't find is you don't find him breaking out the Torah. You know why? The Gentiles didn't care about the Torah. Now, he would have talked the Torah to that synagogue. He disputed with them, but he had to find some common ground to be able to get the gospel to the Gentiles. And so, what does he say? Well, he says, ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are too superstitious. Now, there's a Greek word for superstitious. And the Greek word that is used can be taken one of two ways. One way, you men are very devout and religious with your beliefs. And the other way is, that's just stupid. You're too stupid. You're too stupid to know right. You're superstitious. So how does he mean it? He might have meant it the way that he knows it to be, the second one. But these men, the way that he describes it, you men are devout. You're superstitious, but you're sincere. And so he uses that hook and they're going, yeah, you're right about that. Yeah, we are devout men. We are men that want to honor these gods. There might be 30,000 of them, but we want to honor them. And so he said, for as I passed by and beheld your devotions. What does that mean? That means that there were people that were paying homage to these statues. Now, it bothered him greatly because he knew commandment number two. But these people, they're out there and they are kneeling, they're sitting, they're laying before these wooden or stone idols. And he says, as I passed by, I beheld your devotions to these. And he says, and as I'm looking around, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. And they're going, yeah, that's one of ours. And so what has he done? He has bridged a gap. Well, this guy's been looking at our stuff. He thinks that we're religious. Let's listen to what he's got to say. Can I tell you that when you're trying to win someone to Christ, the first thing you need to do is get them to kind of halfway like you. If they don't like you, you know what they're going to do? Get out of my house. I talked about Benny Hill. He's in hospital. I want to say that Benny and Bill, your husband, Ms. Marge, were out soul winning. They knocked on a door. Come in. Well, they came in thinking, this guy's fixing to listen. I'll be back in a minute. He went down the hallway. He come back with a gun and said, let me tell you guys something. Don't you ever come to this house again if you know what's good for you. They hit the door. You say, what would you have done? Would you have gotten his face? No, I'd have hit the door too. Hey, that's one of those when you just dust off your feet and leave him alone. Because God can get his attention. He don't need to shoot me to do it. And so he makes that connection with them. To the unknown God, whom therefore, now, ooh, he's fixing to sting them now. Whom therefore you ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you. In other words, I'm going to tell you who he is. You don't know him, but there's something on the inside of you that tells you that maybe there's a God that you don't know about. Now, they're trying to cover their bases with all the thousands that they've got. But just in case there's one that they've missed, they got his inscription, the unknown God. They want to make sure that everything's good. That's like one guy that was a missionary. He went to a country in Asia. And in this little small country, he had people supposedly getting saved right and left. And he's like, man, we're doing great. And it was a place that had polytheistic beliefs. And so he was there, and I think it might have been Cambodia. And he said, I'm witnessing it. Would you like to trust Christ? Oh, yeah, yeah. But then he would go to their homes, and they would have 12, 15 other idols that was there, and they had Jesus as one of the 15. In other words, they were just kind of covering their bases. I guess it's like an investing. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Because whenever they died, they wanted to make sure they were going to the good place. And so now he stings them. He says that you are ignorantly worshiping this unknown God. And I'm going to tell you who he is. Now, first of all, let me tell you, it is the God that made the world and all things therein. In other words, this God wasn't created by you. He's always been. All that you see, he did it. Seeing that he is the Lord of heaven and earth, he doesn't dwell not in temples, made with hands. Slapped them right upside of their intellectual noggin. What had they done? Polished, chiseled, carved. They've got all of these things that they have made with their hands. I wonder, when Paul wrote Romans 1, when they began to worship the creation or the creature more than the creator. And he begins to give the description. And, you know, Romans is written probably about 10 years after this. And so I wonder if this story is what he's got in mind when Romans 1 and Romans 2 are being penned. You can check that out. Just read it yourself and think, can I take the words of Romans 1 and 2 and will they fit in the heathen city of Athens? I think you'll find that they fit well. And so, he's the Lord of heaven and earth. He does not dwell in temple with hands. Neither is worshiped with men's hands. In other words, you don't get to stroke your God. No, no, no. God is above all. He is everywhere. You don't get to put him on a wooden stick carved out of a tree. We call him a totem pole. You don't get to take a piece of ivory and carve him and go, that's my God. No, no, no. God transcends all of that. As though he needed anything. God does not need what you're wanting to give to him. You're wanting to give him a stone idol of himself? He doesn't want that. Every time I see a dashboard of a car and there's a little statue on the top of it, I'm thinking, a dead, lifeless idol. That's what I think. And people don't know any better. What about praying a rosary? Get a little swig of water, let you think about that in a minute. Rubbing them beads. You know how much rubbing them beads, if you do it 1,000 times, you know how much closer you're going to get to hearing God? God transcends that kind of stuff. We have this prayer garden out here. And as gorgeous as that prayer garden is, and the solitude that's there, it makes me want to commune with God. But I don't have to go to that prayer garden to talk to God. I can talk to God sitting in my chair in my office. I can talk to God on the way to vacation. And you and I, we need to understand that God cannot be put in a box. He's greater than that. And so he begins to preach to them. He says, he hath made one blood of all nations. Now, what was that all about? Athens, they had a hierarchy. They had the Socrateses, and they had the Platos, and they had the Aristotles, and they had the Epicureans, and they had the Stoics, and they had a bunch of others. And then they kept going down, 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 down. Much like in India, they still have what is called the caste system. And from the very top, where the brilliant people were, we would call them oligarchs, professors, doctors with many letters after their names. That's what we would think of as the upper echelon. Right now in this country, did you know that in the West, underground, they have huge cities that are hundreds of feet under the ground that will house for several years 900 to 1,000 people? You say, why is that? Because they have made preparations so that if our country is hit with a nuclear attack, where it's placed all over the places, say our big cities, and the population is decimated, they would take the special ones. Those that can put society back on its feet. And they will put them in those facilities and everybody else is locked out. You've got that kind of mindset here in Athens. There's some people, oh, they don't get medical care. These people would. They don't get an education. These people would. they have to be a slave, this man can be free. And you have all of those variances there. And what he is saying, he is again, popping them up against their intellectual head. He says, this God made one blood of all nations. Now, what did this God do? He says, for to dwell on all the face of the earth. And what has he done? He has determined the times or the seasons. But then I want you to notice the next little phrase, before the appointed and the bounds of their habitation. What is that? Where they live. Do you think that you're special because God let you be born here? God's been good to me. But can I tell you that I'm just as much as a sinner as some guy that was born in Costa Rica? I'm just as big a sinner as somebody that was from Sri Lanka. I'm a sinner the same way that some guy that worships at a Shinto shrine in Japan is. Just because I was raised in America and I've had the blessed privilege of hearing the gospel does not mean that I am more righteous. The only righteousness that I have is through Jesus Christ. That's it. And so he's preaching to them and he says, you're dead, lifeless statues. God doesn't need them. God made you, put it in your heart that you would know there's a God. Hence, that's why you're trying to worship something, because it's innate. And that's one of the things when I'm witnessing to people that are skeptical and they go, well, you know, religion, that's just something for weak people. And all I'm thinking is, the whole world's weak. That's what I'm thinking. Because everywhere that you go, there's somebody trying to worship something. You know why they do that? Because they know there's something bigger than themselves. And we found it. God has let us be a part of that. The chapter that I alluded to earlier, and I'm going to hurry, I promise. Chapter 16. At the beginning of that chapter, Paul has no intention at all of going to Europe. Not one. His desire is to go into Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey. But he says that the Spirit forbade him. And then he sees this vision of a guy in Macedonia, which is in an area of Europe. Come over here. And he says, I was not disobedient under that heavenly vision. And so he went and was obedient to where he was directed. Had God allowed him to go to Turkey instead of Europe, you'd be in darkness today. You wouldn't have the gospel the way that you have it. God could have very easily directed him in a different direction. But he sent him to Philippi, and then to Thessalonica, and then to Berea, and then to Athens, and before long, he would actually be in Rome. And all those roads that led to Rome led away from Rome, and the gospel began to go through the known world, and ultimately, it got to the shores of America. God blessed us that way. But let's not get cocky. Let's not get prideful as the Athenians had been doing. Oh, they thought they were special because of their history, not knowing that they were dead in their trespasses and their sins. Let me give you a third thing, and I've got to hurry. And this is the payoff. Verse 30, and in times of this ignorance, what ignorance? The times that we're reading about. Can I tell you, to a certain degree, the times in which we live right now? It says that God winked at it. In other words, the ignorance of the sin that was in the culture, God winked at it. Now, he didn't wink at it in the way that the books that I alluded to at the beginning were. No, it has the idea that God overlooked it with judgment for a moment. God had a cataclysmic judgment that took place, and a man that was saved and his wife and his three boys and their wives was a man named Noah. His boys were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. I don't know why I was thinking about the three Hebrew children and Daniel. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They began again after God had judged this world with a cataclysmic flood. It was even bigger than the one that we felt last night. You done forgot. But he gave us the rainbow, promising that he would not destroy us by water again. But don't ever think that just because he's not going to do it with water, that he's not going to do it another way, because the Bible talks about that. We'll see that in just a second. And so God was very merciful. When he, by right, should have just wiped us out and left us gone, he did not do that. There's a story in the New Testament that has given me a lot of things to chew on, a lot of fodder. It's in the Gospels, and it talks about when the Tower of Siloam fell and killed 30 people. And I'm like, man, that's awful that a tower fell and 30 people died. And I'm like, Lord, what is the reason that that is included in the Bible? And finally, it made sense. I heard a man say that the story is not that 30 people that were innocent were killed. The story is that everybody that was living was guilty and all should have died. But the 30 was an example to those that were left. And in my mind, I'm thinking, man, that makes sense. Think about the times that you've done something stupid, but the judgment of God didn't fall immediately. God forbore. He practiced forbearance, patience. Does that mean that that sin will never be judged? Oh, no, it'll be judged. If you're a Christian, it's already been judged. It was judged at Calvary. If you're not a Christian, it will be judged, and you'll bear that brunt yourself. And it'll be an eternity without God in hell, separated from God. And so, in times of ignorance, God winked, overlooked, but now. This is his plea. But now commandeth all men everywhere to repent. Verse 31, our last verse, because he hath appointed a day. Does Hebrews 9:27 not tell us that? It's appointed unto men once to die, and after that the judgment. Oh, there's a judgment coming. And said, he's appointed a day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, in that he hath raised him from the dead. Who is that man in verse 31? He's going to judge the world by the righteousness of that man. That man is Jesus. And hath ordained whereof he's given assurance unto all men by Jesus. And he's raised him from the dead to prove that Jesus is the one. the unknown God that they did not know about it, now they are without excuse. Three times in Romans 1, that phrase is used. Without excuse, without excuse, without excuse. There will never be, ever be, anybody that will stand at the great white throne judgment and look in the face of God and say, you did not give me a chance. If there is a desire to know God, I believe that God will give that person more light, and ultimately they can receive the gospel. The end of verse 31, it says, in that he hath raised him from the dead. One final verse. Romans 10, verse 9. What does it say? If thou shalt confess with thy mouth the Lord Jesus, and believe in thine heart that God has, what's the next phrase? Raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. The same gospel that he told the Romans and the same gospel that we have in our Bibles today is the same gospel that he told the Athenians when he was preaching to them on Mars Hill. In times past, God winked. He didn't slap them down immediately. He's given them time to repent. But the longer you put off the repentance, the greater the punishment will be. The greater the light, the greater the judgment if you do not respond to it.